I'll just read it to start. Another slightly related question, and going back to something I wished I'd asked in course one. I remember Ali, I think, talking about meditation being contraindicated for people who did not have a clear sense of ego or self-sense. I may not be accurate on the wording here. Could you elaborate a bit on what that would look like, and also how you'd use the internal-external distinction in that case? Would it be that the boundary between internal and external has not been properly established? I'm especially interested in this because I tend to encourage all my coaching clients and workshop participants to engage in some meditation practice. Now I'm wondering if that's not suitable. And then the last part's cut off for me. Oh, for some of them. It's on the other page. So yeah, this is a great question, and I don't remember exactly where this came up. I know we talked about it in the last course briefly. I don't remember, Ali, if we put it in course one, if it made it in there. But the first time we really encountered this issue, or at least I encountered this issue, was when we were working through the States lesson with Ken on course one. And we were looking at the dual center of gravity, the self diagram, and basically looking at the interaction between state development and structure development. And the general point that Ken was trying to make, and it's not that he's just making this up, but to be also clear that I am not aware of any research that's been conducted on this, really for the simple reason that when I say this and referring to the maps and the distinctions that we're using, there has not been any research really done fully on many of these concepts using these distinctions. And the point Ken was trying to make here can be simply summarized as, before you engage a practice that's designed to, and I'll word this sort of harshly, deconstruct the ego, get rid of the ego, even though while we don't really prescribe to that languaging since, would rather say, you know, rid the self of an exclusive identification or an unyielding identification with the ego. But any sort of practices that, let's say, mess with the ego like that and the self's relationship to the ego or small self ought to be done or have better, not necessarily ought in a normative sense, but will have a less potentially problematic effect if they're engaged after the ego has been structured, after the boundary of the self-sense, as Ali's been describing, you know, in the previous question, has been defined. Now, it's not to say that you couldn't meditate before that, and typically when Ken brings up examples, or at least what I remember, is he talks about this being a potential problem with you know, his fundamentalist example in the Wilbur Combs lattice of a person with lower levels of development, even though this doesn't hold up so well, I don't think, because it's a levels in line situation, so it's not like the psychograph is low across the board, but certain pathologies certainly could exist, where then contemplative practice or mystical experience is engaged such that it has a distancing or deconstructing effect on the ego, yet the ego is required by the relative vehicle to continue moving and growing and navigating the world, and now the ego is all thrown on the rocks, as it were, before it even had the sense of establishing proper boundaries. So I think we could argue that one cause for this would be just general youngness and development, low levels of development. This does come up in my experience, direct experience, of working with teenagers and children who have just, for lack of a time to be really specific, but let's just say generally have problems, right? Pathologies, low levels of development due to four quadrant full, you know, full-on forces and factors in their lives with the lower fulcrums. And then the postmodern, you know, college grads come in with their newfangled programs and start teaching them all how to meditate. And I've seen this happen. And that type of example is where we'd have to be really conscious of this sort of dynamic. Because most of the, at least the children I've worked with in those settings, group homes, juvenile detention centers, et cetera, are still navigating and cleaning up those earlier fulcrums, mostly in the sense of pathologies, but some of them, depending on how young we're going, actually just in the sense of really fully still navigating F3 and F4 in some sense. So for Jan, I don't think you're probably going to have much to worry about here if you're working with coaching clients and workshop participants. I don't know the work that you do in your coaching and your workshop participants, but if it's you know, work that, if it's someone like you attracting people, you know, who would be, would resonate with sort of your, you know, way of being in the world, as I understand it through your work in this course, I doubt that you're going to be attracting too many people or this is going to be of great concern. Ali could probably say a bit more specifically about what maybe some warning signs you'd want to look out for when somebody might be having struggled in their past, pathologies that haven't been cleared up in those earlier fulcrums. I don't have much experience working with adults in that setting. But generally speaking, I think you're right. And we don't need to make such a harsh prescription about meditation not being safe to prescribe, as it were. And also remember, too, it's not just meditation. It's any types of numbers of contemplative practice or really any sort of experience that has a transrational transcending of the ego effect. Right, so we could go across traditions looking for examples that would fall into the same category. The sort of the meat of the question, the heart of the question here in a theoretical sense is, could you elaborate a bit on what it looks like, an internal-external distinction? Basically, what that looks like is a lot of what Ali just talked about in the sense of how the internal-external distinction could be overlaid with the notion of self-sense or ego. Then you say, would it be that the boundary internal/external has not even been properly established? At that point, I would just make a terminological sort of clarification. And the boundary that we're talking about, kind of where Ali started or where he went second after just speaking about some of the zones in general, is the boundary of the self. So it's actually that horizon in as it arises in the upper left, that boundary between inside and outside. And while we draw it as one solid line, I think you guys are getting the point that particularly in the left-hand quadrants with groups or with individuals, that's a very permeable, malleable, adjustable, not observable boundary. And it's that boundary that's being established. And it's not that once it's established, it's there established like a brick wall never moving. It's established enough to a point where it has sort of an integrity and a structure, which in sort of an auto-poetic kind of way, it has a capacity, the self has a capacity to navigate and reform and reestablish and reconstitute maybe that boundary as the self is moving through, developing through, living through the world. So that's the boundary we're talking about, and it's not so much internal and external as it is inside and outside. Now, internal and external in that sense would be, I like to describe them as boundary relationships in a way. Technically, they're relationships to, you know, that dominant monad, but the agency of the dominant monad also, you know, helps constitute the inside-outside boundary. So in regards to this notion of meditation and ego structuring and then ego destructuring or deconstructing in regards to state experience, I think what we're working here is not just with internal and external, but like Ali led us up to, coordinating internal, external, and inside and outside, and the shifts and the movements across those boundaries as we go. So Ali, you want to add anything to that?
Absolutely, and I'll be super quick just so we can get to the other questions. But the basic gist of it is I completely second everything Clint just mentioned, and just want to kind of add maybe one variation of it just to add to the kind of potential clarity and its, I guess, digestion by people who are listening to it right now. And that is basically... This isn't always the case, but if we are to try to coordinate all these distinctions, we're looking at internal, external, inside, outside, interior, exterior, individual, collective. If you look at the inside, outside, internal, external, just to follow on from where Clint left off, it turns out that, for instance, the self, looked at from either side, self, determines what is inside its own boundary, oftentimes depending on what is also internal to its agency. So such that the more feeble the defenses of the self are, the more unformed the cohesive internality codes of the self are, the more easily contents slip in and out of the self boundary, the more feeble the self boundary is. The problem with this is that since meditation is a disidentification practice, it allows awareness in itself to disidentify from false identities and objects and be reflected back onto its own unqualifiable self. Then it is important for meditative practice to acknowledge the existence of, or at least make sure that internality codes are in place. And even in terms of just psychotherapeutically, prior to Fulcrum 3, any pathology that's prior to Fulcrum 3 uses structure-building therapies. As in, it's actually, instead of uncovering therapies, which are used at, for instance, psychoanalysis, and even 3-2-1 is a very pressure cooker format of an uncovering methodology. It's uncovering your original attachment to this impulse. Actually, for lower pathologies, you use what's called a structure-building therapies because you're meant to strengthen the ego. You're meant to strengthen it to a point where it can actually defend itself. It can recognize itself, it can defend itself, it can be there can be a stable self-sense. Part of the problem, well,
and
won't
particularly,
get it,
Ali, like, I appreciate you getting into this. Let me ask one
absolutely
question. So,
absolutely.
And it's also with structure building, right? You're trying to, Ali's way more knowledgeable about this stuff for everybody, hence the question to him. You're also doing things like learning, right, what is self and what is other.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So when you talk about relationship and when you talk about, you know, some of the earlier, you know, isn't that wrapped up with borderline and even narcissism disorders?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So with meditation particularly, when one of the main threads of it, right, is you are not other than all of that, than all of this arising, witnessing, particularly non-duality, but even some causal practices, that runs directly against, you know, this structure-building notion. And this is a question to Ali.
It's certainly, yeah.
And this is Ali. And this is Clint's emotionality. And this is Ali's emotionality. And when I'm young or when I have pathologies, you know, and you guys can trace this in your own lives and people you know, we don't have a clear sense of that stuff. Now, clearly, I know where my skin stops and where Ali's skin begins. So in the right-hand quadrant, it's like, yeah, I'm pretty clear there. But it's in the left-hand quadrants where we start to get all mushed together because my ego doesn't have a solid boundary. And then meditation really can just jam that up.
Exactly.
In the sense that it's like teaching you that I am Ali.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, part of the confusion just stems from the fact that most modalities just have had, since the get-go, just two definitions of self. There's one true self, and then there's the little self, which is the false self. The problem is, from a more non-dual approach, actually enlightenment is nothing short of the marriage of the most authentic form of form and the most authentic form of freedom. And so this includes relative healthy self level appropriate self-contraction or whatever form is, and includes absolute freedom from form. So such that part of the confusion comes when we qualify the absolute and think the dissolution of boundaries is enlightenment. No, that's actually not unqualifiable awareness. That's another state. And if anything, it's a regressive state. Now, just to finish off, because it's a gigantic topic, but just to finish this off, I won't even get into the five types of selves that integral theory names in relation to solving this or blah, blah, blah. But I'll say this for Jen, for her personal work in coaching, let's just also acknowledge that neither Clinton or myself, nor as far as I know you, Jen, are clinical psychologists, are diagnosticians, or even practicing therapists. None of us are. Right now, not myself, not anybody. I have, you know, a measly master's degree in psychotherapy, and I'm interested in theory. That's it. And I have some hours experience through internship working with clients. My sense is you're never going to know if someone has a severe psychopathology outside of just being open to either finding out about symptoms or just being open to other people's experience and their suffering. So if someone is suffering to the extent where contemplative approaches that you're using are bringing up actual triggers, and if those triggers are actually not able to be mediated by one's own person via little approaches, little kind of colloquial approaches like the 3-2-1 process, the most ethical thing to do is, as a coach, support them in terms of finding resources, you know, finding some sort of therapeutic auxiliary supplement to the coaching outside of the coaching experience. So that's that, and that's what I would do. That's what Clint would do if a friend was suffering, if a client that we're working with was suffering, because we're not clinicians, we're not diagnosticians, and this is strictly having a deep understanding of theory and how it shows up in the world gives you kind of like gives you an upper edge on seeing what's unfolding before you, but also just kind of does not alleviate any responsibility of, you know, freedom through limiting. Know what zones you're able to enact and work on and what zones you're not. And I certainly am not qualified to work with anyone suffering from trauma or personality disorder, or to even diagnose anyone, let alone myself, with any of these disorders properly outside of the supervision of a trained professional. It would be kind of like us giving an example of internal and external in relation to, you know, cancer cells, and all of us worrying about, well, how do we know if our clients have cancer cells? Well, I mean, the best thing to do is if they're suffering from health ailments, if symptoms are showing up, support them in finding resources where they can actually get an accurate diagnosis. That's the only ethical thing I can kind of finish off with right now. And I hope this helped, Jen. And sorry to be so long, Clint.
No, you're all good. This is good. Let's check in with Jen, though. I'll take you off mute. Oh, hold on 1 second.
Hi.
Oh, there you go. You are off mute.
Yep.
Hi, Jen.
Hi. Thank you. I didn't hear the first few minutes, but actually all of it was really, really helpful. And I'm definitely going to listen to it about 6 times more for the first part of the question. But it felt like I could understand it as you went through. I don't think I can hold on to it right now, but I think I can if I hear it a few more times. And the question about meditation, that really helped. And I think I just have one tiny bit more question to that, which is the issue that comes up, which I was wondering, does this mean it's like the ego isn't fully formed? One of the things I work with people in my workshops a lot is being able to say yes when you mean yes and no when you mean no. Just being able to say what you mean and being able to have a sense of not having to do something because somebody else wants me to. And a lot of people who come to me do get into that, you know, just, well, I've been, you know, women just sleeping with every man just because they think that they have to. There's no sense of being able to say no. And so does that fall within their ego isn't fully formed because they're just unable to say no?
Well, without getting into any specific diagnostic criteria, which once again, none of us are qualified to do,
yeah,
we can just simply say it falls in broadly to the notion that further meditation without some sort of, without a kind of like a therapeutic effort to restore and also strengthen a sense of self and boundaries. And this goes for all of us, not just for people with very early pathologies.
Yeah.
Meditation does not guarantee that the dismantling of those boundaries will not result in more harm in the long run. This doesn't mean don't meditate. This doesn't mean don't do that practice. Just know what that practice gets at and what it leaves out. And what it leaves out exactly, and in especially in its interpretations of, you know, oh, it's getting rid of all boundaries. Boundaries stand in our way. That's a very partial view. No, boundaries don't stand in our way. And radical awareness does not contradict the presence of boundaries in any way. It leaves everything untouched, just as it is. And so the untouched part might as well be as healthy as it can. And ironically, it turns out that when level appropriate defenses and when healthy emotional boundaries are formed, that gives a stronger sense of self. And like Jack Angler says, it actually aids the process whereby meditation is supposed to strengthen the ego, not weaken it. Meditation is, ego is just Latin for I. Meditation is the movement from small ego to big ego. It actually gives you a huge ego. It shows you that your ego includes in its compass of care all others without fusing with others in a pre-rational sort of way and without hegemonizing others by projecting your own emotions on them, but caring for them as others because you see yourself in them directly. So meditation essentially is supposed to give you a big, a gigantic ego. It's supposed to liberate you from your partial gross ego. But it's not supposed to that's why Clint said, I'm using this term coarsely, deconstruction. It's not supposed to deconstruct boundaries, because what you're left with there is mush. And radical, unqualifiable awareness is not the deconstruction of barriers. It's the recognition that you're not limited to them. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure I took that all in fully enough, actually.
This is definitely one of the questions. Like you said, you have to listen to six times. I'm just interested in what happens to your self-boundary as you listen to it six times. Does it get constructed or does it get reinforced? I mean, on this notion of you know, what you asked, Jan, about, you know, people who don't know how to say yes or no, I mean, I'm even less skilled than Ali. He qualifies himself as not able to diagnose, and he's not, because he's being, you know, very clear with his ethics here, but he also is far more knowledgeable than me. I have a sense that could be attributed to a number of different things, some of which we've spoken about, some of these lower pathologies, and some of which would be higher. Unable to locate clear intentionality is a higher, distinguishing between an intention that's mine and an intention that I'm getting from you. While it might recruit or wrap up lower pathologies, you know, I've seen it occur up the spectrum. I mean, I have a lot of close friends who are very developed, all things considered, who still fall into very similar patterns, like what you're describing. Mm-hmm. You know, is this my yes, or is this some sort of manipulation or coercion or unclarity where I'm taking on, you know, intentionality that's not actually my own? And that is wrapped up in this notion of boundaries, an internal and external. And basically here it's like my partner's intention for whatever is external to my agency, and yet it can be shoved across my boundary, my self-boundary. It's kind of a reverse of the example with projection and association, pushing it out. Things can be pushed in as well. And I've seen this happen, with two of my friends in particular. I'll leave them nameless in case they hear this recording, where they let a lot in. And it is an aspect of, I think it's wrapped up with what you say, and an aspect that is wrapped up in these distinctions. I wouldn't so much just confine it to, oh, you definitely got a problem down at the bottom.
I wasn't trying.
No, not that you were, but others might or could. So then when you say, is it safe for, you know, I mean, at the core of what we're asking, is it safe or productive, you know, or conducive for those types of folks with those types of issues to do meditation? And at that point, I mean, I bet we could find just as many examples yes as no, because so much else is being activated. And then the key for you is make the appropriate caveats, make the appropriate recommendations, make sure you point out, as Ali did, what meditation doesn't do, what it can't access, what it can't touch, which is typically the shadow and psychodynamic stuff. And recognize as well that what meditation can do in regards to psychodynamic stuff, it oftentimes can create a clearing for that stuff to show up. As the mind quiets down, the kind of junk floats to the surface is a sort of a colloquial, rough way to say it. And in popular culture, demonstrations, usages of meditation, I've heard a lot of reports about that type of thing. It's actually what books like Thoughts Without a Thinker, you know, and Mark Epstein, which is one of the psychotherapists who popularized meditation in that context while making this mistake, not really fully clearly seeing it. Meditation can bring that stuff up, so there it is, but you need to work on it in a different context because it's not going to solve for it. And that itself is another thing to watch out for. That's actually farther, that issue probably spreads further out than the particular issue we're talking here about ego structuring not being where it needs to be. It's just a mistake of thinking that meditation is going to solve those problems in yourself as well, where it might just bring them up but leave them unsolved. And then you can say, well, you know, I don't need to solve them because implicitly, you know, you're spiritualizing, and maybe say they're bothering you and you less because you're cultivating a new relation to the relative realm or to suffering, but they're bothering the hell out of the people around you. They still might need to be worked on in a psychotherapeutic context. So that's the type of stuff you'd want to watch out for. But again, not in the sense of you're responsible for it. You're responsible, I think, for pointing out what this technique is and what's the pluses and minuses, and what are the things that y'all, who, you know, I'm coaching or who's coming to this workshop, need to be aware of if you're going to engage this type of practice. The trick here is that, you know, it's more of a problem now because meditation, you know, used to be, well, in quotes, prescribed as part of the tradition. Not that the traditions were oh so great at handling psychopathology, but, you know, you did these practices in a pretty particular community of practitioners, which have a whole, I think, I imagine, have a whole bunch of dynamics that allowed this to not be as much of an issue as it is now in the modern West, or the postmodern West, where everybody's meditating. Every yoga, you know, studio on the corner mm-hmm. is offering some type of meditation. It sounds like, oh, this is for stress relief and it's to quiet your mind. But, okay, that's a nice marketing spin. And while it's partially true, also recognize these are the 2,000-year-old technologies for spiritual development. Now, not in the particular way the yoga studio is teaching it, but that's what you're dabbling in. That's the realm. And mm-hmm. and there's a lot of differences between how we're using them, most of us, and how they were used in the context in which they developed. So not to scare people away from meditation, I think give them all this information, but this is the type of stuff I think you'd want to track in regards to this, rather than trying to say is his or her ego structured enough, right, to be safe with meditation. And also recognize that if the answer there was no, you likely wouldn't see it, and two, it likely wouldn't become a problem until they took meditation up as a practice.
Yeah.
It's not just like, oh, you sat for a little bit and quieted your mind, and next thing you know, it sort of short-circuited your self-boundary. I think this, you know, issue that Ken was pointing to when we looked, you know, back a couple of years ago in Course One, was sort of predicated on the assumption of the notion of more longer-term meditation. Because the actual transcending or deconstructing, whichever word we want to use, of the ego is not the product of just idiosyncratic instances of meditation. It's usually a cumulative effect. Now, that's not to say that folks can't have satori's, kensho's, immediate awakening experiences, and yes, those, Eckhart Tolle is an example of his whole story, right? Those experiences can be radically disruptive in regards to the self. And that, and Eckhart Tolle actually is a great example of this very issue, I think. Not acting like I know the guy personally or can speak about his pathologies, but he spoke about him himself, at least in some sense. And it's a great example of the power of these practices and the traditional roots that they do trace back to. You know, this trans-rational stuff, and can really, particularly in a Western context, I mean, you know, kind of lost it in a colloquial term, or just describe it colloquially, and then also couldn't find the adequate support in a Western system. Like, well, yep, you're crazy. I call that schizophrenia. I call that, you know, psychosis. Call that whatever. And, you know, if you would have had a mystical or cultural support network, they would be like, yeah, we call that God. know, welcome. Welcome to Kensho. It's crazy and, right, in the Western medical context particularly doesn't. Now, it's changing. This meditation is becoming more popular, but still it isn't as accepting or understanding of spiritual experiences in that sense.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. That is really helpful. Thanks.
For sure.
Yeah.
Thanks for these questions. Great. Get to the heart of some of these issues.
Absolutely.